Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants on this here program are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Archie, Justin's here.
Hey, everyone.
And our guest this week, we got a special guest here. One of the founders of U.S. Renditions, which, if you don't know what that is, they were the very first direct-to-video distributor of subtitled anime in the U.S. way back in the day. It's David Keith Riddick. David, thanks for showing up.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
All right, so I guess we should just start at the beginning. How did you get into anime in the first place?
Okay. That question would take you back to the mid-70s when I was a kid watching television in Los Angeles. There were shows such as The Amazing Three, which was like an early Osamu Tezuka show, and Kimba, Speed Racer. But I wouldn't really say that I was even thinking of it as anime. It was just really, really cool cartoons that were coming on Channel 13 and Channel 9 at that time. The first real anime that I started getting into was subtitled anime that was on a Japanese language channel here in L.A., Channel 22. And those shows were like Yusha Raiden, Getorobo-ji, UFO Diaphalon, Ultraman that was subtitled then. And that's when I was really aware that it was Japanese animation. But even then, it was kind of like a passive, I was just watching it and being entertained by it, but I was really into it at the time. And then all of a sudden, that stopped for a while. As I had just graduated high school in 1984, I went to a comic convention, and the X-Men comic series was very popular then. I was really into it too, but I was kind of bored with what was going on in American comics at that time. I mean, Star Wars had already come and gone. Jedi had was way over, and I wanted something new to kind of get into. I was just kind of drifting around the convention, and I happened upon a booth that was selling Japanese animation books, and I picked up a book called Macross Perfect Memory, which reminded me a lot of the Star Trek Starfleet manual with all the diagrams of the ships and the costumes and the characters. And I remember the earlier shows that I used to watch, like Getorobo-ji and Yusha Raiden, and I was like, hey, this is like the next step from that. And the more I thumbed through it, the more excited I got. And there was also a videotape there, which was the Booby Trap tape that Harmony Gold had released. It was the first three episodes of Super Dimension Fortress Macross. And so I picked up both of those things and took them home and just started really like analyzing it and really getting into it. It was only three episodes, but it was just amazing, amazing stuff. And so I started going to Little Tokyo to try to discover more about Japanese animation, if there's any stores that were selling stuff that was related to Japanese animation. I happened upon Books Nippon and Pony Toys, which was a Japanese toy store that was kind of like the place to get Japanese models and figures and things back then. And there was a flyer at Pony Toys about a Macross movie being shown at a anime club called Japanimedia that was run by Dr. Don Wilson. And so I went to that and saw Macross Remember Love for the first time, and I was blown away by it. So
this
it was like
raw. This was
raw, no subtitles, just raw. And I wanted to know more about what was going on in the movie. You know, what was the actual plot? I knew it looked really different from the TV series. So it was at that point I found out about the CFO, and I started attending CFO meetings, and I met Fred Patton. And Fred had a kind of a major impact on me because he was kind of he was an anime historian, and he knew a lot about Japanese animation. So I wanted to learn as much as I could. But that was my first kind of exposure to organized anime fandom.
And now, if you could just explain to our listeners, because a lot of them are younger, what was a CFO?
Okay, the CFO was the Cartoon Fantasy Organization, okay? And what it was, it had several chapters in different parts of Southern California, and then eventually it expanded and became a national organization. And it was started by Mark Molino and Fred Patton. And basically what it was the chapter that I was involved with, at least initially, was the CFOLA chapter. And to kind of describe what a CFO meeting was like was there'd be an agenda of different shows, different episodes of shows that would be presented to the audience. And these shows were not high def. They were not 1080p. They were often second and third generation VHS copies. That were what I mean by that is that there were copies of copies of copies. And so they were like terrible as far as the resolution to look at. But also fascinating because these were things that were that had just been aired on Japanese TV, not something like in the simulcast way of, let's say, like things like Crunchyroll, how it's done now. But it was more like maybe like with a 4 month or 5 month lag time, something like that. And that going to that CFO meeting was the thing that kind of opened my eyes to this subculture of Japanese animation fandom.
Now, okay, cool. From there, how did Books Nippon, like what was Books Nippon at this point? I wasn't in LA at the time trying to get a metal picture.
Okay, this is what Books Nippon was. Books Nippon was a small store in downtown Los Angeles. That was the retail outlet. There was also Books Nippon with O-N that was in New York. But our story kind of deals with the L.A. store. So it's Books Nippon.
Were they affiliated?
Yes. Yes, they were all owned by Nippon Shupan Hanbai, which is a major book distributor in Japan. And so basically what happened was, I mean, you'd go there and you'd have all these art books. And this is all raw stuff. Or very little translated material. It was all like they were selling like raw videos, books, no action figures, nothing like that. It was just books, soundtracks, and videos. And the animation division was run by a guy named Kevin Seymour, who is becomes a major player in the later story of U.S. Renditions. And so what happened was, just to kind of, I know I'm kind of all over the place, but I'm going to try to make it linear for you. Basically, what happened was I was still obsessing over Macross, Do You Remember Love? And I noticed that at the CFO meetings, people were watching these shows and they really didn't know what was going on. They were just kind of like through context, understanding what was going on. And people were making like their own synopsis up based off the things that they were seeing on the screen, not so much what the people were saying or the characters were saying. So I had a couple of friends, Glenn and Mario Ho, whose dad was a very fluent Japanese speaker, and they knew Japanese as well. And so we kind of pooled our resources to do the first translation of Do You Remember Love in the form of a movie script. And this script was just distributed among the CFO members. And that was a big hit. And that was something among those members. And that was the thing that that translation kind of became big at conventions, and eventually it fell into the hands of Kevin Seymour. And then Kevin Seymour wanted to talk to me to discuss the possibility of doing translated anime for the U.S. market. So I went to Books Nippon, to their corporate offices in Carson, California, and met with Sho Nagata and Satoshi Komatsu and Kevin Seymour to talk about potentially starting a special projects division of Books Nippon. And so they hired me on, but initially I wasn't hired to create these special projects. I was hired to be the director of the Books Nippon Animation Fan Club. And what that was kind of like the mail order division of the animation division. So in other words, people would see ads in, like, let's say a comic book or whatever, and they place an order for animation goods, and then I would ship the goods out to them. And that's how it all started. But as time went on, we became more serious about doing the English language versions of anime titles. My responsibilities started going toward that.
Now, if you could just back up a little bit and tell me a little bit about that meeting. What was the pitch exactly? You know, we want to license and distribute this stuff for this small group of people. We think we could make a lot of money on it, or how did that go?
Well, what it was like, we were all in a room together, and the initial meetings were just with me and Kevin. The other guys didn't come into it later until Kevin kind of got a feel for what I was about, and then we kind of together pitched it to the guys that were from Nippon Corporate. And so basically what it kind of came down to was that they had a database of a lot of people that were buying anime goods in the U.S. And pretty much at that time, you have to understand that Books Nippon was pretty much the number one distributor of anime goods in the U.S. I mean, everyone was getting their stuff from Books Nippon.
So they were really the only ones that knew that there was a market for this stuff.
Right, right. And yeah, I mean, other than Harmony Gold and Carl Mason, they were just trying to do Robotech, which was an adaptation of Macross and Southern Cross and Mospeta. They were doing their own thing. On our end, what we were trying to do was to release more titles, and not so much the idea behind U.S. Renditions was not to adapt them for a U.S. market. More, it was kind of like to do more as a direct translation as possible for the U.S. market. And the idea was to do that as professionally and as true to the original content as possible.
Were there any naysayers?
In the CFO, it was kind of like, yeah, you know, we've kind of heard this before, because apparently there were other people that had attempted to do that. There were failed attempts or whatever. They were kind of like, we'll just wait and see what happens. And as far as naysayers, I would say not so much naysayers that we couldn't do it. It was more just naysayers to anime in general. And what I mean by that is we were going to the San Diego Comic-Con before it was the huge multimedia event that it is today. It was much more like a comic book convention, but it was still major. And there was resistance from the Comic-Con community against anime. And this wasn't just unique just to Comic-Con. This was just what I consider mainstream comic and science fiction fandom.
Well, they never really seemed to like us that much.
No. In fact, anime was just barely tolerated in the early days there. Anime fans were relegated to a small room with a TV, and kind of like, yeah, you know, you guys are kind of this extreme fringe part of the mainstream fandom. Now everybody in 2013, you know, anime fans go to watch The Avengers, and people that may be into X-Men might be watching you know, some anime series now, such as like Sword Art Online or something like that. The walls have been kind of broken down, and you don't, just because you're into anime doesn't mean you can't be into video games. Just because you're into video game doesn't mean you can't be into like X-Men or something like that. There's a lot of cross pollination that's possible now. So,
right. You know. Okay. So, to get back to the narrative of things, how did you get started with like, okay, well, they gave us the go ahead. What now?
Okay. Basically what happened was we Kevin had already done the translated versions of Star Blazers, like Star Blazers graphic novels. He didn't actually write them, but Nippon had them created, and it was distributed through Books Nippon. That wasn't done under the U.S. Renditions name. The first U.S. Renditions project was the soundtrack album for Robotech. And
so you just went to Harmony Gold for that?
Actually, Harmony Gold came to us.
Oh.
And so what happened was Carl, who I met I have to rewind it a little bit. Once when I picked up that Macross videotape, I contacted Harmony Gold to find out more about it. And so eventually they had me on hold for a while. And then the actual producer of the show, Carl Masick, started talking to me about it. And so that was like the first conversation with Carl Masick, and that became numerous conversations with him. He was kind of really trying to figure out the fandom of anime and trying and kind of picking my brain about different things about the current anime fandom, which was like the 1984-85 anime fandom. And actually, I became president of CFO Gardena, which was my own chapter of the CFO, and Carl Masick was like our first guest there. And so that's how I established like a rapport with Carl Masick. So Carl Masick called me and said, hey, you know what? We want to do a project with you guys at Nippon. I want to come and talk to you about it. And so Carl and Kevin and I met with Carl Masick. And at that point in time, the comic books had already been done. The video was already being handled. But a major part of the Robotech story was the music, and there was no soundtrack album. So I came up with the idea of trying to do the soundtrack album for Robotech. And so that was like the genesis of that project. And it was kind of like it was a kind of a good place to start because it was more of a sure shot and an easier thing to negotiate with that rather than like the anime titles that will come later, such as Gunbuster and Black Magic M66, that will come later. But working with Harmony Gold and working with Carl Masick, that was able to allow U.S. Renditions to put out a product that would be successful. And that, by showing the corporate office that our projects could be successful, that opened the door for the later projects, and we can get into that.
I see. So the first thing you guys licensed was Gunbuster. Right. And who was the licensor for that at that point, and what happened when you first tried to contact them?
Okay. What happened was, okay, there were several things that were going on at that time. Once we did the Robotech soundtrack, the vinyl version, we started coming in contact with key people that would be major players for the in the future version of the nascent anime industry. And one of those persons was John O'Donnell, and the other person was
I know John O'Donnell.
Yeah, John O'Donnell from U.S. Manga Corps. And we met John O'Donnell at a film convention, but it was just for industry people. And it was actually for video just distribution. And so we met with him, and he was really excited about what we were doing. And I just kind of met him at the open bar. It was just like by chance. And so I introduced him to Kevin. And so then he saw what we were doing. He wanted to do something similar. And so basically we kind of assisted him with the formation of U.S. Manga Corps. And eventually Robert Napton, who was also a member of U.S. Renditions, worked with me on Dominion Tank Police, and that was like their first title
I always wondered why you guys were in the credits as translation for that.
Right. Back then, it was kind of like there was more of a spirit of camaraderie between the companies, the earlier companies. There was a maybe friendly competition, but we all kind of knew that we were so niche, you know, such a niche market, we couldn't really afford to be at each other's throats. You know, we were kind of like, you know, we would be happy when Anime Ego released Bubblegum Crisis. That was great, you know. And when we released things, you know, it was more of a spirit of camaraderie back in those days, as I remember it.
Yeah, we could take a lesson from that now. How did you guys reach out to the licensor?
Okay. Kenny Otomy was in charge of a company called LA Hero Communications, which was the LA based Hero Communications, which had ties to Bandai. Okay. And so in our meetings with Ken was the one who really worked with us to get the rights through LA Hero to release Gunbuster and Dangayo, Black Magic M66, and Appleseed. And almost simultaneously with this, through a gentleman by the name of Torrin Smith, we were able to make contact with Toshio Okada, who was one of the lead figures in Gainax, which was, of course, the studio that was responsible for Gunbuster and Wings of Onyamas. So that kind of like all the chess pieces were coming into play at that point.
I see. So Ken basically was your licensing arm.
Yes.
I see. Yes.
Yes.
How did the pipeline work? Did Ken just kind of get what you could, or was there discussion as to like, oh, this would be awesome if we could do this, etc.?
Okay, Ken presented Kevin and Robert and I, this is what I can bring to you. This is what they're willing to open discussion about. You know, Gunbuster was one of them. You know, Dan Guile was another one. And pretty much we said, hey, we're going to try to do them all. The ones that he presented, the ones that we felt would work with the our audience, those are the ones that we went with. I'm sorry if I'm a little all over the place with this. This is stuff that happened a long time ago.
Oh, this is 20 years ago.
Right.
30, more, is it?
Yeah, 20, it's a long time.
Okay, so the first tape comes out, and how did you get it into stores, and how did it sell?
Okay, the tapes did amazingly well, and basically how we got them into stores were we already had ties with a Diamond comic distributor and other comic distributors like Diamond to get the product into comic book stores. The person that basically empowered us to get the product into places such as like Sam Goody and Tower Records was John O'Donnell. He was the one who was the person that kind of gave us and shared knowledge with us about video distributing. And that's how we were able to do it.
And of course, to remind people, this is an era where comic book stores were everywhere and flourishing before the big crash.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's much different than today.
Yeah. So if you could just tell us like how things went from there, like, you know, this went really well. What do we do next? You know, that sort of thing.
Okay, right. Okay. Talking about Gunbuster and all those things, it was a really exciting time for me in my life because it was kind of a dream coming true. And I was on a mission to kind of like, you know, spread the word about Japanese animation to all the people in the mainstream science fiction fandom. You know, we were trying to make it more popular among those people, and also trying to, you know, just raise the awareness of anime and manga and Japanese culture, pop culture in general. And where we went from there, Gunbuster and Dan Guile were episodic. And this was in the middle. You have to understand that we were in the midst of the OVA boom, right?
Right.
So there were a lot of original video animation, direct-to-video titles that were being released. And Gunbuster was one of them. Dan Guile was one of them. Black Magic M66 was a one-shot, and that was one of them as well. But we knew that in order for mass acceptance to come, we'd have to start doing dubbing. So one of the first titles that we did with that was Macross 2. And we jumped on that because it was being marketed at the time. Hey, this is the sequel to Macross, Do You Remember Love? Now, we never saw it moving. We just saw illustrations, you know, that were being done by Haruhiko Mikimoto and the mecha designs and stuff, and it looked great. So that was like one of the first ones that we felt that would be a sure shot to start our dub line with. And also Orgus. And then eventually we U.S. Renditions did Guyver and Giant Robo. And those were like the first dub titles that we did.
Right. Now, who basically, I mean, you decide you need to dub this, but that's kind of a daunting prospect, especially in the days before Pro Tools, when, you know, anyone could record on their computers. So what... how did you go about like finding a studio? What was that whole process like?
Okay, Ken had already had a studio lined up for the dubbing, which was a studio called Magnitude 8 that was run by a guy by the name of Les Claypool, and that's the studio that U.S. Renditions used for all their early dubs, and eventually that studio was also used by Bandai Entertainment as well.
Before you go any further, I have to ask, Les Claypool, is he the guitarist?
No.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, go on. I always wondered that.
No, he's not the same guy from Primus, right?
Right.
Yeah, no, that's not him. Different guy.
Okay.
So anyway, Magnitude 8 was also involved with another project that didn't have anything to do with U.S. renditions, but was an LA Heroes release, which was the Guyver live action movie with Mark Hamill and also Guyver 2 Dark Hero. And
a cinema classic if ever there was one.
Absolutely. And they did those. And eventually, once U.S. renditions ended, Robert Napton went and was working with Bandai. And then Kevin Seymour went on to form his own dubbing company called Animes. And they did, of course, Giant Robo, Code Geass.
Cowboy Bebop, Ghost in the Shell.
Yes. Yeah. Right. So U.S. Renditions was kind of like the birthplace of the current modern anime industry. Because we were the first company to do the first subtitle releases.
Right.
Shortly followed by Animego.
So it sounds like it was all fairly smooth sailing, at least by today's standards. Were there any like major catastrophes or fires that had to be put out in those days?
Well, I could tell you one of the things was we in my anime fandom days, it was kind of like the cool thing about it was like not only was I working for U.S. Renditions at the time, but I was also running an offshoot club from the CFO called the American Alliance for Japanese Animation. And we did the first 35mm showing of Castle in the Sky at Equicon in L.A. And it was the first time. And that was like really problematic. Tokuma Shoten gave us the prints to run, and it was just super problematic. That was one major hiccup, but we got it done. And
where was the problem?
The problem was just getting the thing to run on the machinery.
Oh,
yeah, that was a projection issues and stuff.
Oh, okay.
In regards to, I'm trying to think back any major hiccups. You know, really, there's nothing I can really say as far. We were operating in an already niche market. It wasn't like the mainstream pop culture. It was just kind of like in our own kind of like a focus group or interest group. There's no real problems with it other than there was a lot of like in those early days there was a lot of like a anxiety because we felt that it wasn't going fast enough. It wasn't growing fast enough. There was so much material to be that to be released and so much we wanted to do that there was like kind of like an anxiety about getting it out. Like, are we putting this stuff out fast enough? We need to, there needed to be more releases, more, a more rapid form.
I see. So basically was there any, were there any releases that just you expected to do as well as, say, Gunbuster and just completely fell on their face?
I'll tell you, one of the things that I always wanted to work on was the Macross Do You Remember Love, but that never even happened.
Oh, right.
Yeah, because at that point in time, when we did Macross 2, Harmony Gold had the rights to the TV series of Macross, but not the sequels. But as we now know, they own the rights. You know, there was a big fight between Big West and Harmony Gold, and now they own the rights to the name Macross in the U.S. So we were able to release Macross 2, and eventually Manga Entertainment was able to release Macross Plus before that happened. And then once it was finalized that they owned the rights to it, then that pretty much
– That was that.
Macross Do You Remember Love never received a proper release in the U.S., which is sad.
Yeah, it's a bummer.
Mm-hmm.
But there, as far as you remember, there weren't any what were the big hits and what were the big misses in that catalog, if you recall?
Okay, well, Gunbuster was a huge hit,
right?
That was like even to this day, it's kind of like the U.S. renditions flagship title that everybody remembers. People think
how many copies was a big hit back then? Because that's changed a lot.
Really, as far as the actual numbers. We sold easily like over like, I would say like 7,000 copies each of Gunbuster. I don't have the exact numbers of how much they sold.
Right.
But I would guesstimate it wasn't as much as now probably.
Actually, that's about the same.
Yeah. Yeah, it's about 5,000. About 5,000, 6,000, something like that.
That's a hit here nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sad. It didn't used to be.
yeah. It was only like as I remember, it's like two episodes of tape, and it was like $34.95. That was the pricing then.
Right.
But people were just happy to get what they could get back then. I mean, it was kind of like people were very appreciative of what we were doing, because other than Animeago and U.S. Manga Corps, nobody else was doing it. In 1991, there was the first major anime convention where there's a collaboration between the Japanese studios and the U.S. Market, U.S. fandom, which was AnimeCon 91. And that was kind of like the origin of Anime Expo as we know it today. And at Anime Expo 90, AnimeCon 92, they had, that's where we released the dub version of Macross 2 and Orgas. That's where those were debuted at.
How did those go over?
Super well. Super, super well.
I'll bet everyone was just fiending for what they could get at the time. And I was
right. Oh. And that's what it was. I mean, no, people were liking, I mean, Dan Gaio, I mean, they were liking it all, even Appleseed. You know, they liked it all. I mean, pretty much when people.
I like how you said even Appleseed.
Well, yeah. Even Appleseed. And that was what, personally for me, that was kind of a disappointment, because again, when we got the rights to do Appleseed, I was a huge fan of Shiro Masamune's manga series, which is this beautiful, detailed, super technical manga. And that, I thought that we'd be seeing some of that in that video, and it wasn't like that at all.
Yeah, not so much.
No, not so much. Yeah. So, it was the growing pains, right?
Right. Well, that's cool. Something happened with LA Hero. And I think most of it went to Manga Entertainment, or what happened there?
Okay. After U.S. Renditions ended, mm-hmm. the catalog went to Manga Entertainment, and Manga Entertainment released a lot of it, a great part of it. Eventually, Orgas was bought by Imagination.
Yeah, that was me.
That was you, okay? And it was released under that company. But that's pretty much what I know.
Did you part ways before U.S. Renditions ended?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I left U.S. Renditions in 1992 to become a broadcast engineer for Marketplace Radio at KUSC.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And so
you stayed in media after that, and you went on to bigger and better.
Yeah, I went on to that.
Okay.
and then basically I was still involved in anime production, because Orgas still needed to be done, and Robert Napton was in charge of a lot of the production at that point in time, and he was the person that handed the Orgas project off to me. So I was still kind of working, not as an official member of U.S. Renditions, but kind of like a consultant, so to speak, with them.
I see.
And so I did a subcontractor. So I did like the complete ADR scripts for Orgas, all the way from episodes 1 through 35. Some of them were done by Trish Ladeau as well. And actually directed like the final three episodes. But this, Those were credited to Yutaka Masuba, but actually I was the one that directed those.
Now, most people know Trish Liu and Toshi Yoshida from their work at Viz and, later, but were they in LA at the time?
No, they were always like Northern California people, but we were, you could say U.S. Renditions was the company that kind of gave Trish Liu and Toshi Yoshida their start, because they were the people that did the volume 2 and volume 3 of Gunbuster, and eventually Trish Ladeau did actual voice acting and did some voice acting in Macross 2 as a Wendy Ryder. which was the idol character in that show.
And Outlanders.
Yep. Yep. She did. She did that too.
Well, awesome. Looking back at this whole thing, was there anything? What are you most proud of? What would you have done differently? Like what stands out in your memory?
Okay, looking back at that time at U.S. Renditions, you know, I was a young guy, young film student at Cal State Long Beach, and you know, a lot of other people that were in my classes were not working in the industry at all, and I was actually part of starting an all new genre for the American market. So that was pretty exciting. I'm really proud of being involved with U.S. Renditions because it was a unique and opportunity to be part of a trailblazing company. And the thing I'm saddest about would be that Nippon Chupon Hanbai didn't realize that at the time, they were the conduit for anime in the U.S. And had they really, really monopolized that, they'd still be the top players today. But because they were booksellers and book distributors and not so much media production people, that's where it all kind of collapsed a little bit.
Could you tell me a little bit more about that? Like what did they not get specifically?
Well, what it was is that, you know, Robert Napton and I were very enthusiastic and we wanted to expand U.S. Renditions kind of aggressively. And they were proceeding very slowly, or what in our mind, being 21 years old or whatever, at a very slow rate. I think that pretty much they knew that they had something, but yet they didn't quite know how to capitalize it. And it was just a frustrating time with that, trying to make them understand. Yes, they were backing us with the products that we released, but we wanted to expand the market in a much more aggressive way than what they were used to.
Do you know how the company ended or why?
Okay. Books Nippon ended sometime in, I'm guessing here around 1995, 1996. And the name Books Nippon was sold to a company, I think it was called Digital Media. And Nippon Chupon Hanbai kind of pulled out of the U.S. Robert Napton and Kevin Seymour had left the company by that point in time. And that marked kind of the end. Even though there was a company that was calling themselves Books Nippon, they weren't the real Books Nippon. The real Books Nippon was a company that was owned by Nippon Chupon Hanbai. And so
it's basically pretty much, like,
if you want to look at the, it kind of like you could say the timeline, it's like, you know, U.S. Renditions starts, U.S. Renditions ends, and then eventually out of that, Bandai Entertainment got started. And you could say that Bandai Entertainment was kind of like the end game of what started with U.S. Renditions.
So basically it sounded like, you know, things moved too slow, all of the fresh meat, as it were, went elsewhere, went to greener pastures, and the party just kind of fizzled.
That's it.
I see.
In my mind, yeah, that's what it is. The party went on; it just went on somewhere else.
Right.
Yeah, the party went on with Bandai Entertainment. To me, was kind of like, even though it ended recently, that was like the ultimate expression of what we were trying to do. Those were the guys that and animes too. Animes. You know, really took dubbing and dubbing technology like to the next level, and from where we started, because I'll freely admit that the first dubs that we did weren't all that great, but we were kind of learning as we were going along. But Kevin Seymour really perfected the art of dubbing, and to me, he's like one of the best voice directors that ever came out of the genre. Of course, you know, Kenny Yatomi and Robert Napton went on to do Bandai Entertainment, and they have a great, great, great catalog. So,
or had.
Yeah, or had. Right.
Who from that era do you still keep in contact with?
I'm still in contact with Robert Napton. I'm still in contact through Facebook with Trish Ladeau and Toshi Yoshida. I haven't really been that. I talked to Kevin Seymour maybe around 2002, 2003. I'm not really in contact with him that much. I'm still in contact with Kaniotomy through Facebook.
Okay. And you see him at conventions and the like.
Of course, yes.
Yeah. What's your current you're more just a fan these days, correct?
Okay, yeah, you know, the way I see myself now is kind of like a fan, but then also somewhat of a historian, because I kind of lived through this important part of anime, the anime industry in the U.S. So kind of part amateur historian and part fan. I'm still a fan at heart. You know, I was a fan that was at the right place at the right time, and I was able to do some pretty incredible things based on that. And I owe Books in the Pond and U.S. Renditions a lot for that.
What stuff do you currently watch, and what have you kept up with the scene?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I've done a few panels, a panel at Anime Expo last year that was standing room only. I did some panels recently at Anime LA. I did a panel last year at Pacific Media Expo, and I'm planning on doing some things for Anime Expo this year as well. And I might even be going to Otakon this year. So I'm still active in that way as far as doing panels and talking about the old days and the early days of the anime industry in the United States.
What from that era is important for you to preserve?
Can you be a little bit more specific about that?
Like, I mean, it feels like preservation work, what you're doing now, as far as, you know, keeping the spirit of that era alive. What is it about that era that you want people to remember the most?
What I want the current fandom to know is that it wasn't so easy to get anime as it is today. Today, you've got Neon Alley, you've got Crunchyroll, people doing BitTorrent, whatever. However, you're getting it, buying it. It's much easier through the internet. The internet changed everything. Back in the days of U.S. Renditions, there was no internet. So basically, people were a lot more appreciative of anime and its creators back then. So I think what I want to remind people is that although anime is huge now and it is doing well, it came from very humble beginnings. And it's important to remember that we still have a long way to go to make to get anime where it needs to be in the U.S. And they shouldn't take it for granted. So I guess the most important thing I would say to the younger generation is don't take this for granted. Continue to support legal distribution of anime, support the shows that you like, support the artists that you like. You know, the cosplay movement is gaining traction here and actually it's doing really well. I like seeing all that stuff. And it's funny because as I'm walking through these conventions, it's kind of like, you know, you see all these young people wearing these costumes. In a way, I was joking with Robert Napton saying, like, these people are kind of like our kids, but they don't know us. And so I guess you could say that's my function now. It's kind of like to say, you guys are enjoying all this. You're enjoying your cosplay. You're enjoying your manga and your anime and the whole, as they call it now, the otaku lifestyle and everything. But there were people that kind of paved the way for you to enjoy that. And those people were like Kevin Seymour and Trish Ladeau, Robert Napton, you know, Kaniotomy, and people like me. And it came through a lot of personal sacrifice to that allowed that to happen.
Awesome. Well, I believe it's time for Twitter. Zach, what do you have for us?
Well, actually,
sorry, you probably have some.
I would just before we do Twitter, I did have a quick question because back then I didn't get into anime until like mid to late 90s, so like 96, and the era that you're talking about was waning at that point. A lot of those old guard guys were still around. You mm-hmm. know, and they were fans. They started in 1985, 1986. And back then, and especially with organizations like the SPJA, the big goal was, excuse me, it was evangelism, like you were saying. It was spreading the message that this stuff is great and everyone should watch it.
Right.
And I'm curious, if you look, when you look at fandom now, especially like, you know, the super ups and downs of the industry and everything, do you look back and you say, well, mission accomplished?
It's not mission accomplished yet. I think that the early mission was accomplished, but today's mission is still ongoing. If it's a battle, if you can call it that, it's still going, which is still to spread the word and to get the word out. It's a lot easier now. People have the internet, and you know, you have websites like Kotaku, and you know, anime, of course, you guys, Anime News Network, that's blasting the information out to thousands, if not even millions of people that are following you. But back then, it was a lot more difficult, and so I think that the mission is still to the spreading of the word of Japanese pop culture and spreading the word of Japanese animation to the masses. That's still the mission, but now, you know, it's up to the younger generation to spread the word even further and take things further. And I think they are. You know, I think it's amazing. I mean, right now I'm a guy in my late 40s, and I can pick up my my smartphone and watch anime on my smartphone in damn near high definition. And to me, that's amazing. You know, that's really amazing. That what before, you used to have to know someone and have someone, you know, make a tape for you, tape a tape of a tape. And you have to go through all these, you know, this arcane like subculture to get access to anime. You have to go through, you know, jump through so many hoops to get access to it. Now it's just so there for you. And it's almost like, you know, you got Hulu, you've got Netflix, and so many different titles to watch in such great quality. It's just it's the on demand high definition culture, and I find that absolutely amazing that's how far it's come. But I think there's still, you know, room to grow.
Okay, all right, well, that's very interesting. We've had a few people from that era on. And it's always interesting to me to determine whether or not they feel like the mission that they had back then has become to fruition.
Yeah, my part, if we were soldiers, my tour of duty was kind of over. Right. But but the war continues. You know, the battle continues. So the struggle continues to raise consciousness of Japanese animation in the United States, and you know, to the world. It's because with the internet, it's the borders are pretty much diminishing, and it's not just about getting it to the U.S. It's about really spreading it throughout the whole world.
Yeah, well, the borders are gone. Now the mission is, how do we make money on this stuff?
right, exactly. Exactly.
Okay, so we got some questions for you on Twitter.
Okay.
Zaruda asks, he's got a couple of questions here. I'll just do these one at a time. Why didn't you dub the rest of Orgus?
Okay, we didn't dub the rest of Orgus because the U.S. renditions ended. And when U.S. renditions ended, that's what stopped the progress on the Orgus series.
Okay, pretty obvious answer.
Right, but what I will say is that I completed all the ADR scripts all the way to episode 35. So let's say if Bandai Entertainment ever, you know, like our Bandai Digital or whatever happens in the future decides to release Orgus again, they already have those scripts written. Sorry. So that's something. The possibility for Orgus to continue is there if they take advantage of it.
Okay. Interesting that those scripts exist. He also asks, did you make money on Macross 2?
Books Nippon made money on Macross 2.
Okay.
U.S. renditions made money on Macross 2, but as far personally, no.
Right.
You got that was another issue about, you know, this is another thing about the early anime industry. We were doing it like pretty much out of love, because as far as like the money was concerned, the early people that were working in the anime industry weren't getting paid that much.
Right.
So pretty much it was out of the love for the medium. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Okay. He also asks, actually got a lot of questions here from him. Did you get a cut of the live action Guyver?
A cut?
A cut. I guess he wants to know if U.S. renditions somehow is involved in some sort of profit sharing thing with that.
No.
No.
I wasn't involved with Guyver. Guyver happened after I left.
Right. Okay. Then you can't answer his next question either. Okay. Daryl Bueno asks, he's, as a member of the digital generation, I'd like to hear stories of the equipment you used in the early days to subtitle anime.
Okay. What I can tell you is that we used early Mac computers to do that. And that's what I can tell you. As far as the software, the name of the software and stuff, I don't know.
Okay, well, it's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. Almost, it's been a long while.
Did you ever have any interest in, also from Zerda, any interest in co-producing things? So, like, U.S. Renditions would potentially be involved creatively in the production of an anime. Did that ever cross your mind?
Yeah, that was part of the plan for in the long term. We, you know, with things we wanted to do, like, cooperative things with, in fact, that's interesting that you brought that up, because I can talk about something that I'm very proud of. A lot of people don't know. Once we started work on Orgus, there was a sequel series idea that was being tossed around with LA Hero Communications, which was the Orgus 2. They wanted to do a sequel to Orgus. And Kenny Otomy actually approached Robert Napton and I to pitch our own story for the sequel of Orgus. And so Robert Napton and I, along with Rick Sternbach of Star Trek The Next Generation, came up with this, with an idea. He actually drew a Orgus mech suit, or mecha suit, that would be involved in the sequel. And we pitched the idea to Hero Communications. But eventually they went on with what became Orgus O2. But that had never been done before. No, at no time had any, you know, company like that approached American creators and asked, would you guys pitch an idea as well? So that was something interesting that not many people know about. And I still have all that material, including the illustrations from Rick Sternbach with me. So that's another high point of my career. When, even though it was never created, just the fact that they asked us to contribute, that was amazing.
Okay, Hosokari asks, basically boils down to, did your translations, the subtitles that you did, the scripts you had, did those have to go through an approvals process with Japan?
No.
Wow.
Ah, so nice.
No.
Those are the days.
But to be honest, I mean, as time, I mean, the earliest translations from U.S. renditions were not without flaw, such as the infamous Sidekick Wave gaffe. And things like that, but you have to understand in the early days of U.S. renditions, there was Trish Lado and Toshi Ishida weren't doing those translations. Hero Communications wanted their own translators to do it. That's why there wasn't an issue of us having to go through an approval thing with them. They had their own person that they wanted to do it, and that's kind of how all that happened. Once we got Toshi and Trish on board, our translations improved dramatically.
Could you tell our listeners about the Sidekick Wave gaffe? Because I don't think a lot of them know about it.
Okay. Yeah, basically what happened was during one of the battles, the characters would call out the names of their attacks as they were doing them, just like in Gunbuster, which was the lightning kick and things like that. One of the attacks was a psychic wave, like a psionic attack type thing. And it was mistranslated to Sidekick Wave, and that's and actually made its way out to the public, and that was like one of the biggest mistakes of U.S. renditions that people wouldn't let us live down. But it was good. It was good in a way because it made us want to get better and better and better, which we did.
Were you now? Obviously, anime fans are famous for giving the companies grief. Did it get nasty at all about that, or was...
Yeah, a little bit. Fans were really into collecting anime. And back then, you got to understand, today's anime fan it's more social. So they go to the conventions. They are posing in their cosplay. They're sharing the photos with each other. It's a lot of like social media involved. It's very very social activity. Back then, it was more these guys that were really studious and really serious and collectors. They were collecting the figures. I mean, and I understand it still exists today, but it was not. It wasn't so much social. It was more like I find these tapes, I find these books, and I might talk to somebody else about it, and I'm going home to watch it, or I'm going to these clubs, you know, to watch it. But it wasn't as open and as social as it is today. I don't know if that answers the question.
Well, kind of. I mean, were these the translators that were doing that initially? You guys weren't even getting scripts, right?
Yeah, we got this. We got the Japanese scripts to work from, and then they were given to the designated script writer to do the translation, and then we were given that script, and then that was in turn put to the subtitling process.
I see.
But once, like I said, after that initial subtitle projects, we were able to get better translators and a more professional looking subtitle font, and things just got better. You know, there was a lot of continuous improvement happening.
Learning curve.
Okay. Land of Obscusion asks, Gunbuster got re-released, but Dangayo hasn't, not counting manga's dub-only DVD. Why do you think that is?
I have no idea. I don't know why. I think Dangayo has, and eventually U.S. Renditions did release Ixer 1. I think that those are both great examples of the type of OVAs that were being released back then. I'm not sure why no one's picked up Dangayo now. In fact, there's a whole bunch of series that I wish would have been released here in the U.S. One of them was Dragonar. Another one was Heavy Metal Elgime. You know, there's a lot of great series that you know, we never got to see here. So maybe some company will eventually want to do like an anime classics line or something like that to bring those old titles out.
Okay. AOI Podcast asks, how did you come across licensing Giant Robo and Appleseed? And you mentioned you were familiar with Appleseed before you actually saw the anime, but what was Giant Robo like? What was that process like for you?
Okay. Giant Robo was something that was done, the translation was done, I believe, with Shishlado and Toshi Yoshida, and that was handled by Kevin Seymour in Animes. So I'm actually not sure. I'm not sure if Trish and Toshi did the translations for Giant Robo, but I can tell you that was handled completely by Kevin Seymour's dub company Animes.
Okay. Black Otaku 1 asks, Orgus was your first and only attempt to release a TV show. Were there other TV anime that you wanted to release under U.S. renditions?
Like I said, yeah, we wanted to do, you know, Dragonar, we wanted to do Elgime. Eventually, Dunbine was done through Harmony Gold. And that was one that we liked. There were of course, Gundam was something that we always wanted to do, but Gundam was eventually all released from with Bon Entertainment. So even though U.S. renditions never released Gundam, the fact that Bandai was able to release so much of it here, it feels like a win. Even though it wasn't under my, it didn't happen on my watch, so to speak, but it happened as a result of my watch. So I'm kind of proud of that too.
Cool. Okay, that actually wraps up our Twitter questions and this show. So can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing stories of ye olden times with us. It's always good to at least preserve this history and give people a chance to learn about it in the first place. So really, can't thank you enough. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks a lot. And one thing I'd like to say is if you're on Twitter, you can follow me at David K. Riddick.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to David for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a rating, a review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week.